Welcome back to the Marketplace Petrostate podcast, where we ask, is the U.S. becoming an oil and gas titan, power behemoth? And if we are, what does it mean? I'm Scott Tong, sitting at the Marketplace Sustainability Desk on this Friday, January 25, 2013. Today, oil and gas fracking and renewable energy. Can we have two booms at once in brown and green energy? And of course, our BS detector on environment and energy. But first, the numbers. All right, this being energy, we're going to look back a full year for some context. Gasoline. The average price nationwide last year downshifted a little bit by 6 cents to $3.29 a gallon. Crude oil slid too the past year. A barrel of West Texas Intermediate slipped 4% to $95.23. Natural gas. Wow. Prices are down in historical terms, but maybe we've hit a bottom because since last year, prices have risen 40% to $3.55 per million BTUs, $3.55. And solar energy? The sun rose 44%. We're talking installed photovoltaic energy in the United States. In the news this past week, the president surprised many in his inaugural address.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it.
And in the news, the proposed Keystone XL pipeline to carry oil sands from Canada down to the lower 48 cleared a big hurdle. The state of Nebraska approved a revised route, leaving a decision now in the hands of the Obama administration. This is the Petrostate Podcast. And now to fracking and renewable energy, either or both and. I'm joined now by Ethan Zindler, Washington analyst at Bloomberg New Energy Finance, a market research firm.
Fossil fuels have stolen a lot of the headlines, or the natural gas story in the United States. And so for Americans thinking about kind of the energy future, they think about that. They also think about renewable energy. And they wonder, we wonder, can you have both at the same time? What's your general answer to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes, but I think it won't happen automatically. So, you know, one of the fights that we've seen in the U.S. has been for subsidies for renewables. That's sort of an ongoing battle. And there are some who say, you know, if you just put renewables up against gas, then, you know, we'll get both.
Cheap natural gas.
Right.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is if you want to have both, at least in the short run, you probably need to continue to subsidize renewables for a while. But ultimately, and by ultimately, I don't mean like 20 years from now. I mean within the next, you know, 4 to 5 years, these renewable energy technologies will be the price will have come down sufficiently that they will continue to get deployed without subsidies. And then you can basically have a world in which you get more natural gas and more renewables, and you don't need to spend a tremendous amount subsidizing renewables to make sure that that happens. But one other thing, and it's not quite answering your question, but something to also take into consideration, is also we're seeing real improvements in energy efficiency going on in the economy as well. Not necessarily because people are sort of driven by climate or by being green, but because they just want to save some money.
On the subsidies, then I could imagine people coming back and saying, okay, well, if these renewable energies are in 5 or 6 years are going to compete on their own with fossil fuels without subsidies. Why don't we get rid of them now?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen this industry grow from about $40 billion a year in new investment to what we tracked at about $300 billion 2 years ago to last year about $270 billion. That's real money. On the other hand, It is still a relatively immature industry compared to the conventional power generating sector that uses coal, gas, nuclear. And it's still small potatoes compared to those industries. So, you know, there is a case to be made for the fact that these industries need to continue to be subsidized until they grow large enough that the economies of scale are so substantial that costs are low enough to compete with fossil generation without those subsidies.
Small potatoes, I think, is one of your papers that threw out the number 6%. Kind of globally, is that right? In certain terms of power generation, renewable
that
energy,
roughly
it is in the neighborhood
of, yeah.
Of okay, so if I have a pie and I slice it into eight, right, that's like half a slice. The International Energy Agency, that a lot of people look to for the kind of fairest look into the future, they say it could be as much as a third. By 2035.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, how long is that off? I just thought of, so my second grader, he'll be pushing 30.
Yeah, yeah.
Then. Not too far off. Yeah. Suddenly it'll go from half a slice to a third of the pie. In general, is that a reasonable picture?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing some countries where it's, at certain times of the day, it's well over a third of the pie already. And certainly in parts of Texas sometimes, and in Germany at times, you know, you have that going on. So, I mean, I might say we might get there faster. The question is, you know, or really the point is that it just depends on how quickly the technology costs come down and how quickly we can get to the point where it truly makes more sense for someone who owns a home to have a solar system on their roof to pay their electricity than it does to pay the local utility every month. That is actually, that sort of future actually has already arrived in some parts of the world. And it's important to note, without subsidies. Obviously, for a number of other parts of the world, it's arrived with subsidies. So, you know, the faster we see markets like that convert, where it becomes more of a better economic choice to do renewables than it does fossil fuels, obviously, that's the faster we get to, you know, the promised land where these technologies are really competing on their own and growing their market share very, very rapidly.
Right. And so let's talk about your study from 2012, looking at 2012 and investment into renewables internationally. What'd you find?
As I said, even with it being an industry that's attracting about $1 trillion over the last decade or so, it's still small and it's growing rapidly, and it has booms and it has busts and it has ups and it has downs, and that is sort of inevitable. When you grow as fast as this industry has, you'll have moments where you have substantial oversupply. And that's basically what happened last year for solar and for wind. In both cases, the world simply has more manufacturing capacity out there for those two technologies than there's been demand.
Another brand new study you have out looks at wind energy in the U.S. here. And there you found a surge in investment. I mean, what's the headline number and why?
So, the U.S. had an absolute bang-up year for wind installations last year, with 13,200 megawatts installed over the course of the year. That shattered the record from a few years ago of about 10,000 megawatts. You know, this was it was truly unprecedented. And what, of course, was, I think, exciting and interesting for the industry was that a lot of the action didn't just take place in states that require certain amounts of
clean energy. A lot of states have these renewable energy requirements that utilities have to buy X percent of non-fossil fuel
energy. Exactly. Okay. There are 30 states that have those requirements. But actually, a lot of the interesting action last year took place in states that don't have those requirements on the books, but just have fantastic wind resources. So, for instance, Oklahoma and Kansas, two states that do not have state-level supports, installed 2,600 megawatts between them in total. And the wind just in certain parts of Oklahoma is just incredible.
Because it's a good deal.
It's a good deal, exactly. That's definitely true. The one thing I would say, though, is that has been coupled with this key subsidy known as the production tax credit. So when you have great winds and you get what is a subsidy of $22 per megawatt hour of power that you produce, then the economics can be really good on those kinds of projects.
Right. What stands in the way of these renewable energies kind of scaling up to these giant amounts, you know, relative to the other energy sources in a short period of time. That is why, even for the people who see a big future for these industries, does it take so long to get there? Maybe 20, 30, 40 years?
Yeah. Well, first, it should be noted that nothing in the energy industry happens overnight. I mean, they just shut down a coal plant around the corner from where I live that I think was about 40 or maybe even 50 years old.
Yeah.
So things happen slowly. Change comes gradually. And actually, within that context, the last 4 years have been, I think, almost 5 years, just say, has been almost nothing short of revolutionary.
Oh, in energy time.
In energy time. Things happen slowly in our industry. That's the first thing to keep in mind. And the second thing is that within that context, you know, that these technologies have been making fairly incredible progress. I mean, just in the last 18 months, the cost of a solar module dropped another 40%, and that was on top of, you know, it falling by more than half and over the last several years. I mean, it's been dropping very, very sharply. So, you know, it will continue to take time to drive these costs down. And that's really what it's all about, is costs.
All right. So finally, we want you to play BS detector here. I mean, okay. We want to kind of get at myths and misperceptions that we hear in the public discourse.
Yeah.
So in your fields, you know, from one side of the debate versus the other side of the debate, give me one or two on each side, as it were.
Well, we're in Washington, so how much time you got?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so I think the first is that the Environmental Protection Agency is, quote-unquote, killing the coal industry.
The war on coal.
The war on coal. There are certainly, don't get me wrong, there are certainly environmental groups who are quite literally, you know, trying to kill coal. But the reality of it is what's hurting the, you know, U.S. coal power generation right now. And by the way, they are exporting plenty of coal. But what's hurting the coal industry domestically most of all has been that natural gas prices have just absolutely plummeted. And natural gas has become so competitive with coal for power generation. So,
you know, so gas is, it's a little more accurate to think of gas as killing coal.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. So on the flip side, we've reduced U.S. emissions because of all these regulations, and it's been the action of any one sort of political party that's done this. That's also not true because yes, there's no question that the Obama administration, on some of the rules that they've put on coal power generation, have been fairly aggressive, and those, you know, are going to have some impact.
Fuel efficient cars,
right? And but there's fuel efficient cars as well. Uh-huh. There's no question that that's had an impact. But again, gas has helped to make their efforts look all the better. One other thing that I think definitely, I mean, as somebody who's, you know, our firm really, all we really want to do is mainly track the, you know, the costs and the amount of money.
Yep.
And the thing that kind of makes me nuts is when I hear people misquoting the actual data and facts about how much clean energy costs right now. I repeatedly hear numbers cited that are 2 or 3 years old for the cost of, say, wind generation or solar generation.
Which for these technologies is forever ago.
Exactly. It's like saying, oh, yeah, you know, my iPhone, it can only do 3G because that was what the iPhone 3 could do, you know, 18 months ago or whatever. I mean, it's like it literally is that same kind of technology evolution. And so if you're not getting the latest information, if you're not within the last 3 to 6 months of the data you're citing, then you're doing a disservice to people. And then the last one, I don't know if I could, gosh, I could keep going, but the last one is that,
one more.
I guess one more. Yeah, I know you probably done, but the last one is that the argument that the Department of Energy Loan Guarantee Program has been, you know, a total failure or a total waste of money. This is often the sort of Solyndra talk. There's no question there were some big mistakes made around Solyndra. I won't even sort of try to like defend that. But the aim of what that program has tried to do in terms of supporting next generation technologies is actually, you know, fairly unique. And while there are a lot of countries that talk about doing things like having a green bank or these other kinds of things, the loan guarantee program actually was one of the very first to really put some real money and some real muscle into trying to do this. So the fact that they've had some losers, frankly, should have been expected. I think was expected internally. May not have been articulated externally by the administration. But the reality of it is that program has, I think, planted some very important seeds in a lot of ways. And we will not know whether, you know, some of these were successful who knows, for the next several years, maybe 5 or 10 years even. So I think that that program has come under a lot of heat, and not all of it fair, although the cylinder thing is certainly not something I would try to defend.
Okay, Ethan Zindler, thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott. My pleasure.
And that is the Marketplace Petrostate podcast for this Friday, January 25th. Thanks for listening. I'm Scott Tong in Washington.